Uploaders note, this audiobook was made using the free program Balaboka, and uses the text-to-speech voice soft scan Daniel. It is entirely AI generated from one file, so chapter navigations are not available and pronunciation may be odd at some places. Begin book. This one is for my father, who was there in 72, and said he'd end the war. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. What really matters is that he came back. And in memory of my mother, October 22nd, 1973, who knows where I was on that day 21 years later. Acknowledgements. There may be many reasons you're reading this book, but here are a few more. Ginger Buchanan, who gave me my first chance, absolutely and without question the editor from heaven. Chris Osmo, who gave me a second chance when it really mattered. Dr. Omar Omland, who gives so much by listening. My sister, Patricia, and my brother, John, who got me through some long nights. Charles and Stephen Willard, the best research assistants in the world. Jose Rivera and Dave Walp, who founded a company where my dream could flourish. All the people at Horizon Data Corporation who, in one way or another, gave me help, ideas, suggestions, or an occasional kick in the butt when needed. All those without whom Quantum Leap would not be real, especially, in this case, Mr. Dean Stockwell. And above all, Sid, who alone knows how much of this story is mine, and how much is hers. Rule numero uno. Kid, we did it. Preface. In July 1970, the US Army declassified a photograph for publication. The picture of an American POW being held captive in Vietnam won the Pulitzer Prize the following year. By March 1973, all living American POWs from that conflict were reportedly brought home. In 1974, an Army reconnaissance photograph of a field near the Cambodian border showed the SOS, cut in the grass, of a recently captured American POW. Operation Phoenix was organized a month later as a covert joint forces operation made up of members from each branch of the armed services and overseen by a select Senate subcommittee. Its objective: to free American POWs still alive in Southeast Asia. Prologue. Dr. Donna Relazzi closed the 200-page volume in front of her, her mind welling with abstract mathematics and quantum mechanics. She ran a hand through her hair and glanced at her watch. It was after midnight, and she was finally tired enough to sleep. For 4 years she'd had only one goal: to bring her husband, Dr. Sam Beckett, home. The Retrieval Project, funded as part of Project Quantum Leap, was her priority, and the 200-page addition to that program, a new theory on what kept them from being able to retrieve Sam from time, and a recommendation for updates to the computer that ran the project, was her latest presentation to the committee. They hadn't been convinced enough by her findings to warrant allocating any further resources to it. Donna rubbed her eyes and stretched, realizing she was going to have to bite the bullet and ask Al Kalavixi to pull some strings. Again. Her office, devoid of almost all character, sat beneath the earth of the New Mexico desert, an isolated refuge from the tumultuous activity that took place above her and the rest of the project. In the 4 years since Sam had first leaped, and she had buried herself in this office, she'd never bothered to decorate it. Somehow, it seemed, that would be admitting to herself that her husband wasn't going to come back very soon, and that she would be working down here a long time. She turned to the pictures on her desk and sighed. Two pictures, the only sign of personality in the room. "Good night, Sam," she said, as she did every night. "Whenever you are." She pulled in a deep breath, then spoke into the air. "Ziggy?" Yes, Dr. Elazi. The sultry female voice of Sam Beckett's hybrid computer filled the room. Has he leaped yet? No, Dr. Elazi. Donna looked back at the picture of her husband. I love you, Sam, she whispered. Perhaps, as he shifted through time, he would hear that. And remember. Donna looked at the other picture, the picture of her father, Colonel Edward Wojcie Howitz. It was the only picture she had of him, and it seemed to belong here. The image was frozen in time, frozen in memory. He'd given her the picture the last time she'd seen him, the night before he left to fight a war that never was. The night before he never came back. For Donna, her father would be forever 40. He would be forever handsome. And he would be forever missing in action in Vietnam. It wasn't often that she still felt the open wound of never knowing what had happened to him. But tonight, just for a moment, she did. I miss you, Dad, she whispered. She fingered the petals of the yellow rose she kept in a vase between the pictures. Then, as she did each night, she shut off the lights in the office and left the room. Day 1. Sunday, June 15th, 1975. Chapter 1. Sunday, June 15th, 1975. 9:05 a.m. The plane had landed. The passengers had departed. The lieutenant hefted his garment bag over his shoulder and searched the crowd for other naval uniforms. He saw none. He moved through the security gate and started for the bag gauge claim. That was when he saw it, the dress white uniform of an ensign in the United States Navy. The lieutenant swallowed and took a deep breath, walking toward the young man, who had not yet seen him. Ensign? The kid turned, startled. Lieutenant? The young man smiled. Welcome home, sir. I have a bag, the lieutenant said. He could hardly believe how young the kid was. He couldn't believe he had once been that young. Young? In uniform. And at war. Yes, sir, of course, sir. The lieutenant swallowed tightly and took a deep breath as the ensign began moving toward the baggage car. Uzel, assuming he would be followed. The kid was suddenly nervous. Quick, jittery movements and a gaze that moved too quickly away from the lieutenant's eyes had replaced the first smile of welcome. The kid was ready to wet his pants. The lieutenant followed him to the baggage area and waited nearly 4 minutes for his solitary duffel bag. It was out of place on the conveyor belt, a single military bag among scores of brightly colored satchels and overnight cases and a collection of more business-like suitcases. The lieutenant swept it up quickly and pulled away from the crowd. The press of people was making him feel sick. The car's this way, sir, the ensign instructed, and the lieutenant followed without comment. The ensign led him through the maze of Dulles International Airport toward the short-term parking lot. As the lieutenant stepped out of the terminal, he stopped, stared around him, and closed his eyes. The ensign moved back to his side and stood quietly for a moment. You're home, sir, he said quietly. You're really home. Washington in the summer. He had forgotten how beautiful it could be. Gentle winds gusted from time to time. People walked through the parks with their arms around each other. The tidal basin was clear and quiet. The ensign hadn't tried to make conversation as they'd walked to the car, nor after they began driving. I'm supposed to take you directly to Bethesda, the young man had said, and when the lieutenant merely nodded once in assent, he began driving without another word for. The ensign chose a more scenic route to Bethesda, off the 1-495 beltway that circled around the Washington Met. Repalatin area. The traffic in the district was heavy, but it moved well. and the lieutenant watched everything that passed the windows. My wife. The question seemed to startle the kid. They told me she's been notified, sir. It was another minute before he could ask. When can I see her? The kid swallowed twice. I'm not in charge of the arrangements, sir. I'm sorry, I don't know. The lieutenant sighed and looked around the car. Radio work. Oh, yes, sir. Here. The ensign turned the knob and music came screeching out. The kid seemed flustered and quickly turned it down. Sorry, sir. I was listening to it on the way to the airport. What is that? Disco, sir. The lieutenant nodded and listened until the end of the song. The ensign turned back to the road, still not meeting his charge's eyes, still moving nervously. Beatles. Sir? The kid paled at the word. The group. The Beatles. Are they still popular? The ensign sighed with relief and said, they broke up, sir. In 71. Past history to the ensign. Today's news for the lieutenant. He wanted to ask more, but the kid looked like he might pass out. You okay? Oh, yes, sir. I'm fine, sir. Look, no one's called me back, quote, sir, for years. How about you drop it for now? Yes, see, if you want. The lieutenant almost smiled. I'm not going to fall apart, ensign. You don't have to worry about that. I know, see, I know. Well, it sure isn't the heat making you sweat. The kid clenched the steering wheel and licked his lips. My father died in 68. In Nam. Yes, SSS, yes. He was captured. The lieutenant stared at the young tormented profile next to him, seeing his own recent past come to life and the boy's grim determination not to let go of the small amount of control he still had. And the ensign drove silently for another block. When they came to a stoplight, he said, I'm afraid you'll want to talk about it. And I'd rather not hear. The lieutenant smiled and let out a quiet, bitter chuckle. Relax, kid. It's over. It's past. This is what counts now. The ensign turned hesitantly and looked the lieutenant in the eye. Thank you, SS, thank you. You're gonna choke on that word if you can't say it, aren't you? The lieutenant asked. He waved his hand in a circle. Well, then, go ahead, make yourself comfortable. Thank you, sir. The rest of the drive was silent, but the nervous tension in the car was mostly gone. The lieutenant watched the people and cars that passed them, noticing how little of everyday life was familiar to him now. The music, the clothes, the cars, the Congress, the president. Everything had changed. Everything was stranger than where he'd come from. Stranger than what he'd called home for almost a decade. Sir? The car had stopped. The tower of Bethesda Naval Hospital loomed above them. The lieutenant took a deep breath and got out of the car, reaching behind the seat to rescue his bag. Sir, before we go in. He waited. The ensign's discomfort had returned. I'm supposed to take your dog tags, sir. The lieutenant stared at him, not comprehending at first. Then voices in his memory came back. Deals, exchanges, bribes. He took a deep breath, pulled his only identification over his head, and handed it to the young officer. He had agreed to the terms. The ensign took him in, walked him confidently through the maze of hallways and corridors, and finally stood at outpatient registration, waiting until a clerk noticed him. The smell of sterility in the hallways made the lieutenant's stomach knot. He hated hospitals. I'm Ensign Davalos. Dr. Mears is expecting me. Curious, the lieutenant thought. They were dead serious about the routine after all. His name wasn't mentioned to the secretary. It was the ensign who was expected, not him. It was funny in a pervised way. The secretary checked a log on her desk and nodded. Room 2485, ensign. Down the hall, take the elevator to the second floor, turn right. It's at the end of the hall. The ensign nodded and gestured the lieutenant to follow him. All military hospitals look the same, smell the same, feel the same. The smell of fear and alcohol, the clacking of shoes on shiny linoleum, the ugly lights that hung from the ceilings and made everyone look sick. The lieutenant followed the ensign to room 2485. The kid knocked and a voice inside the room called to enter. The office was spare and plain. Government issue bookshelves, desk, chairs. No carpeting on the floor, and one of the overhead lights was burned out. The room was dark and full of paper. Lieutenant Doe? I'm Nathan Mears. The captain behind the desk stood and extended his hand to the lieutenant. Dr. Nathan Mears was in his 50s, the lieutenant estimated. Dark brown hair going gray, wrinkles around his eyes. He was fit, his handshake was firm, and there was something comforting in the stability he offered. This was not a man who would want to pick his brain for information, or psychoanalyze him, until hell froze over. This was a military officer, a naval officer, a man trained to do his work, and get on with the next task. Welcome back, Lieutenant, he said, and gestured his guest to sit in the chair across from his desk. He turned to Davalos and said, thank you, Ensign. That'll be all. The lieutenant turned to the ensign, sorry to see him go. He managed a half smile. Good luck, sir. The door closed quietly, and the lieutenant turned to the physician. Can I get you some coffee, Lieutenant? He offered. The lieutenant shook his head. My wife, he said. When can I see her? A hesitant second too late, the doctor sat down and said, we've got a mountain of paperwork here, Lieutenant. I'm sure that can wait. The lieutenant's congenial attitude left so fast it startled Mears. He planted his fists on the desk and looked down on the senior officer. When can I see her? He repeated very slowly. The man met his eyes for a few seconds, then lowered his gaze slowly to the desk. I guess there's no easy way to tell you. The knot in the lieutenant's stomach tightened, and he felt a familiar rush of terror. He waited. He was good at that. The doctor looked back up. Backquote, Lieutenant, your wife has remarried. The lieutenant stared. The words didn't make sense. A horrible taste of panic started in his mouth and he swallowed it out of habit. When? In 1969. You were listed as Maya. By the time we got word you were still alive, she'd had the Navy declare you backquote presumed dead and remarried. Slowly the lieutenant sank down to the chair. He said nothing. The memories, the hope, the love, it was all gone. Everything he'd come back for was gone. The deals he'd made were worthless now. 4 years he'd clung to that one small hope. One day he'd come back to her. It had kept him alive. It had kept him sane. He wasn't sure how to breathe anymore. Did you tell her I was back? He asked. The words fought the chokehold in his throat, and came out cracked and twisted. Yes. Where is she? Dr. Mears fidgeted with the papers on his desk. Actually, Lieutenant, the Department of the Navy will have to give you the details. I want to know where she is. She was life and sanity and everything he had. He had to find her. Mears met his eyes and sighed quietly. I don't have that information, Lieutenant. I'm sorry. I'll see what I can find out for you. The lieutenant stared at him, not believing, even yet, that what the physician said could be true. The world he'd clung to was gone. She was gone. She hadn't believed he'd come home. She hadn't believed he could survive what they'd done to him over there. "There's some preliminary stuff we have to get out of the way now," the doctor said, "but we can wait on the rest until later. There's a room set aside for you. Once we get through these papers, you can rest if you like." The lieutenant slowly focused on the noise across the desk and opened his mouth to respond. But there was a snake churning in the pit of his stomach, winding its way through his chest and up into his throat. He couldn't get a word out. He swallowed and felt the muscles in his throat spasm with the effort. "I'm sorry, Lieutenant." He couldn't move. Whatever wasn't being devoured by the snake simply wasn't there. There had been a time, almost 2 years ago, when the pain had been so bad that everything else had stopped existing for him. He remembered lying very still, not moving anything, not breathing, not blinking, so the pain wouldn't find a part of him that wasn't being consumed and attack it. He remembered the bloody stench of the hooch where that pain had become a god, and he had almost obeyed its death wish. The thought of coming back home to her had kept him alive. One more minute, one more hour, one more day, one more year. He didn't feel the tears on his face, but some part of him had cracked open, and he had to be alone. He stood and headed for the door. "Lieutenant, you can't leave now. We have to get Lieutenant." He walked down the corridor, saw it spinning around him. He found the elevator and punched the call button. He heard voices and saw men running toward him. He stepped into the elevator and waited for the door to close. The voices came closer, became louder. His vision blurred as the door enclosed him in the compartment. Small, confined, familiar. He pressed one button, then another. Then he sank slowly to the floor, huddled in the corner, and cried, "Admiral? Are you awake?" Ziggy didn't sound like a computer. Her voice was human, sultry, petulant, and it intruded at the worst possible times. Al Kalavixi kept his eyes closed, ignoring the call for a few seconds as he tried to wake up. "I'm now." He surrendered to the inevitable and swung his legs over the side of his bed. He sat on the edge, rubbing his eyes. "What is it, Ziggy?" "I've located Dr. Beckett." Ziggy stopped and waited for the Admiral to pull the details from her proverbial teeth. It was only one old Ziggy's more endearing idiosyncrasies. "Well, where is he?" "Bethesda, Maryland." There was a tone in Ziggy's voice that Al didn't like. "And? Drive Beeks is in the waiting room now. Dr. Beckett has leaped into a naval doctor stationed at Bethesda Naval Hospital." Al stood up and began dressing. He glanced at the clock on his nightstand and grimaced. 0330 couldn't God, or time, or whoever, leap salmon at a decent hour for those who had to monitor him? "Backquote on my way, Ziggy. Have someone make up some coffee, will you?" "Drive Beeks has seen to that, Admiral." The command center was bustling with activity. Gushy, the head programmer who seemed never to sleep, was updating Ziggy's information on Sam's leap, presumably finding all information local to Sam's current location. Next to him, Dr. Tina Martinez O'Farrell generated the hand link that would contain the most up-to-date information Ziggy could give him. They were comparing notes as they worked, a scene as familiar to Al as his own quarters. Of course, he had never understood how Tina could stand so close to Gushy, whose infamous halitosis was usually noticeable even across the console. Al let his gaze wander over Tina's slender form, enjoying the view, appreciating the tight red sweater she was wearing, but when Tina was working, she never seemed to notice if he was in the room. Off duty, of course, was another story. At least, it had been until recently. He must have screwed up again, and so far Tina wasn't telling him how. These days, she wasn't telling him much of anything, in fact. To the left of the table high console at which Tina and Gushy worked, was a door that led to the imaging chamber. Al headed for the console, checked that the chamber was online, and pressed his palm onto the identity scanner for Ziggy. Here, he turned in time to catch a mug filled with hot coffee that landed abruptly in his hand. He smiled gratitude at Verbena Beeks, the elegant black psychiatrist's expert scion, usually comforting and serene, held his attention. He took a sip of the coffee, surprised at how fresh it was, and kept his eyes locked on her, waiting. She wasn't volunteering anything. "What is it?" Al asked, wondering if Verbena had started taking lessons from Ziggy, how to irritate people in three easy steps. "Let's talk." She turned and went toward her office at the other end of the hall. Reluctantly Al followed, drinking coffee as he went, still trying to wake up. Dr. Verbena Beeks hadn't settled for the project-supplied furnishings that littered the rest of the complex. Once Sam Beckett had leaped, changing forever the original purpose and intent of the project, Verbena Beeks had found herself in the unenviable position of counseling anyone on the project who needed the help, and providing indirect counseling through Al for Sam when needed. Naturally, she wanted an office that encouraged people to come in and feel comfortable. So she replaced, at her own expense, the metallic desk, the uncomfortable chairs, the gray metal filing cabinet, the overhead lights. She had turned the office into a warm, richly colored haven with leather chairs and settee, a walnut veneer filing cabinet, oriental rugs, and brightly colored abstract wall hangings. It was a mix of traditional and contemporary that made most of her charges feel comfortable. Al took the seat across from Verbena's mahogany desk, and waited until she had poured herself a cup of coffee. "So," he launched, "what's wrong?" "Sam's leaped into Bethesda Naval Hospital," Verbena started. She waited, as if expecting some reaction. "So Ziggy said. A doctor, right?" Verbena nodded, watching him with a look that made him squirm. Bethesda Naval Hospital. June 15th, 1975, Verbena said slowly. "According to Ziggy, you're a patient there." "Oh, hell." Al did a lousy job of covering. He shifted his gaze away from her and ran a hand over his face to wipe away the memory. She spoke before he could begin a covering lie. "Ziggy says that, according to your official Navy medical records, you weren't a patient at Bethesda in 75. In fact, you were never a patient there." Al swallowed. "Then why does Ziggy say I'm there now?" he asked, grasping at a straw. It was too late, he knew. His reaction had been too unguarded. "She's picked up your brain waves along with Sam's. Want to tell me about it?" In the instant between her gentle invitation and Al's response, he regained control of himself and the situation. "I can't." "Can't or won't?" "Can't." "You don't remember it?" "I can't, Verbena, so just leave it alone, okay?" Verbena drank some of her coffee. "Alright, you don't have to tell me. But Ziggy needs asterisk to know. Like hell she does." His vehemence caught Verbena off guard, and Al realized the sentiment had to have seemed misplaced to her. "I mean, it doesn't matter, it has nothing to do with Sam's leap." Verbena was watching him carefully. "Well, Gush is still feeding local data to her, but she can't figure out what Sam's there for, and aside from a patient whose record shows he was never there, she's having a hard time coming up with a hypothesis. Trust me, Verbena, Sam's leap has nothing to do with. Why? Me. How do you know? Because I know, okay. There's nothing there that needs to be fixed, it isn't me. He took a sip of coffee, then asked, who'd he leap into? A Chinese man. Not Zyro. For an instant the panic returned, and he looked away. He turned to her, only when he was back in control. Yes, a Weezheng Zyro slash, she said. If Al could have left the room, he would have. But he'd slopped running away from himself a few years ago, and he'd stay at least enough to complete the conversation decently. He was your doctor? Verbena prompted, a clear I knew it, to her question. Al said nothing for another minute. Sam's not there to change anything that happened with me. He wasn't looking at her, he stood and headed for the control room. He's not there because of me. His cup of coffee sat forgotten on her desk as he left. Chapter 2. Sunday, June 15th, 1975, 12, 13 p.m. The first moment of disorientation was familiar. It left quickly. Dr. Sam Beckett looked around, found himself in an office, seated, and not being assailed by anyone at the moment. There was a patient chart open on the desk in front of him. The rest of the desk was neat and orderly, almost compulsively so. It was rare to leap into a new situation, and not instantly have to respond to someone or something demanding his attention. He checked out his new surroundings. From the diplomas and certifications on the wall, he found himself in the persona of a Weezheng Zyro. Harvard, class of 61, board certified in psychiatry. There were no pictures in the room, and no mirrors either, but at least he could guess he was a Chinese male. He looked at his left hand, but there was no wedding ring. And the lack of pictures in the room seemed to confirm that he was a childless bachelor. Given how hard it usually was to find out who and where and what he was from my Caradier Peter Leap, this one was going pretty well. The sound of sirens beckoned him to the window, and he found himself looking down from three floors up over the emergency room entrance. An ambulance pulled in, and was lost from his view. Judging from the trees, he was probably on the East Coast, he decided, and more than likely it was spring or early summer. He turned back to his desk, and found a calendar. June 15th or 16th, 1975, the calendar showed 2 days, and he couldn't be sure which day it was. But he'd narrowed the field considerably. And given the date, he estimated he was probably in his late 30s, assuming he'd graduated Harvard on schedule. He heard the door slide open and turned around, surprised and pleased. Al. This was turning into a dream leap. He knew who he was, when he was, roughly where he was, and now Al was here, sooner than usual, to fill him in on the rest of the details. The all-important why being primary. But Al's expression, not to mention his color, left Sam with a sudden sick feeling. Hi, Sam, Al began, punching the hand link as he spoke. He was looking nervously around the office, as if afraid someone might see him. The observer seemed to have dressed hastily. His colorful outfits were always coordinated, at least in his own eye, but Sam had learned over the years to read Al's costumes. What he wore now: a dark blue shirt with silver threads shot through it, deep blue slacks, and a vest splattered with both colors was unusually restrained. Coupled with the observer's obvious discomfort, Sam took a deep breath and prepared himself for the worst. Someone was going to die. What's wrong? The question brought a guilty look to the observer's face and his gaze continued to dart around the room. Nothing, really. Nothing, Sam repeated. Al, you look like you're going to jump out of your skin. What is it? Al took a deep breath and rubbed his hand over his face. He looked at Sam. Well, it's, you know, the leap. There's a little problem, Sam. It was a phrase he hated. Sam closed his eyes and shook his head. He turned away from Al and stared back out the window. Is it Ziggy? He asked. Well, no, not exactly. Al's hesitancy made him turn back. The hand link squealed rudely, and Al shook it, irritated. Then what is it? Well, you're a doctor, Sam. And you're stationed at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. Maryland, Sam repeated. He'd been right about being on the East Coast. He waited, but Al wasn't continuing. And it's June 15th, 1975. Al hedged. Well, Ziggy isn't sure why you're here yet. Okay, so why are you here? Al took a deep breath and pulled a long drag from the cigar in his right hand. Well. He let out a sick little laugh that Sam knew well. There's a patient here that or, hell. A patient, Sam repeated. Something happens to one of my patients? No, no, that's not. I mean, Al took a deep breath. 20. Let it out, and faced Sam squarely. I'm a patient here, Sam. There, it was out. Sam said nothing for a moment, still not comprehending Al's discomfort. Of course, it was tricky to come into contact with a past version of Al, or of himself, for that matter. But it had happened before, at least twice. Maybe more, Sam couldn't be sure. And in each case the disaster they had imagined looming on the horizon had never materialized. So why did Al look like a malaria victim? Okay, you're a patient here. So. Well, the thing is, Sam, it'd be a good idea if you, you know, just kind of avoided me. I mean, the past me, you know, while you're here. Sam nodded slowly, still not understanding. Al wasn't coming clean yet. He didn't say anything. The silence would drag it out of Al better than a question. Look, Sam, it's just it'd be a good idea if you just kept a low profile until we know why you're here, okay? A low profile? Who am I, Al? Your name is Wendell Zyro. You're a naval doctor, right? Wendell? Sam asked, glancing back at the medical degrees hanging on the wall. Comma. Yeah, well, you're a second generation American. Graduated cum laude from Harvard in 1961, comma. One no, Sam interrupted. So why do you want me to keep a low profile? I mean, what happened to Wendell in the original history? Nothing, Al said, staring at the readout on the hand link. He punched a few buttons, bringing out a predictable squeal, and shook the small machine. Sam waited through the ritual patiently. Wendell Zyro married in 78. He's got 2 kids. He's retired from the Navy. He lives on the Cape. There was a sneer in the last sentence. Sam smiled. Well, then, it must be someone else, right? So, get Ziggy to figure it out. Al pressed whatever was on the hand link that opened the door and stepped backward. Yeah, I'll get Ziggy to figure it out. In the meantime, Sam, I'll keep a low profile, Sam promised. The door slid shut on the malaria victim and Sam shook his head. Doctor? The office door opened as he continued to stare at the spot where Al had disappeared. wondering at the man's discomfort. A woman in a nurse's outfit stuck her head in cautiously. Yes, that patient is awake. You wanted me to tell you when he woke up. The woman might have been reasonably attractive, but she looked tired. Creases around her eyes were filled with smudged mascara, and her lips were pale and dry, as if she'd been licking them a lot. Her reddish-brown hair was touched with gray in wisps that strayed from beneath her cap. But all in all, she seemed harmless, possibly even friendly. He couldn't read her name tag from across the office, and she showed no signs of actually coming in, so he smiled, unsure of himself. The patient? Lieutenant Doe, she prompted. Sam fixed a stilted grin on his face and nodded. Prehending. Lieutenant Doe. The nurse cocked her head and wrinkled her forehead. Are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. He didn't finish the sentence. The nurse gave up her distance and came into the office. She reached across his desk and held up the chart that had been lying open in front of him when he'd leaped in. You're supposed to do the evaluation, she reminded him. He took the medical chart from her hand and opened it. Right, the evaluation. I just need a couple more minutes to go through the chart, he said, his forehead wrinkling as he leafed through the pages. Everyone was stamped top secret. Lieutenant John Doe must be some hotshot, he thought. The nurse was watching him, not certain. Well, tell me if you need anything else, she said, and started toward the door. He had the feeling she was expecting him to say something more, but he couldn't think of anything else to say. Yeah, thanks. She closed the door behind her, and Sam sat at the desk to read over the chart. He knew he had a medical degree. It had come in handy once or twice on his leaps. But having a medical degree and having a degree in psychiatry were entirely different. He wasn't comfortable with the idea of plodding through another man's psyche without training or help. The chart wasn't organized like any other medical chart he could remember having handled. To begin with, there was no registration form, no in-processing documents at all. The patient history was also missing. There were references to some classified documents that, presumably, the real Wendell Zio had seen. The front of the chart contained a list of all personnel who were authorized access to Lieutenant Doe. They included a Dr. Nathan Mears, himself Wendell, three nurses aides, and a Captain Robert Barrows. He skimmed quickly through notes scrawled by Nathan Mears earlier in the day and gleaned little insight into the patient. The man was admitted for a routine physical and psychological evaluation for continued active duty. Sam was familiar enough with military procedures to know that, in the Navy, in 1975, no psychological evaluation was routine. Dr. Mears's notes indicated that Wendell Zio was scheduled to do a psychiatric evaluation this afternoon. The patient had been sedated and started on a dextrose and water forth at 11 a.m. And there had been a bevy of blood tests. One taken earlier in the day had shown a dangerously low blood glucose level. There was no indication that he'd been admitted for diabetes or hypoglycemia, however, and no indication as to what had prompted the sedation. Once more, Sam found himself frustrated by the apparent assumptions in the record. Something disagreeable was going on with this patient, and Sam began to wonder if this was why he was here. He took a deep breath and left the room. His office was at the end of a sterile white corridor. Fluorescent lights dangling from the ceiling did nothing to warm the place up. There were no pictures on the wall, not even something inspirationally Navy, no decorations anywhere.